Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Omega Leadership Series show, where we bring the principles of the Omega Leader to our listening audience each week as we gather at Studio G to talk about what it means to be an Omega Leader. This week we are in the studio with Lori Beth Jones, author, best-selling author of 14 books. 15, I think now. Glad to have you, Lori Beth, this week to bring more perspective to our discussions. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Representing the business pillar, we have Vicky Arteaga. Welcome, Vicky.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And representing the education pillar, we have Alisa Holston. Welcome, Alisa.
Great to be here.
And I'm a little bit under the weather this week, but happy to be here. My name is Shelley Buckner, and glad to be streaming live over the Internet. If you want to log in, just go to blogtalkradio.com/Lori-Beth-Jones, and you can join us live from the Internet, or you can dial in at 347-994-2928 and listen to the show. You can also join us in the chat room and leave us a question for Lori Beth or anyone else on the in the studio tonight. So we're going to jump into our discussion this week, again talking about the principle of perspective. There are two particular chapters in Jesus in Blue Jeans that we are going to address tonight, and Lori is going to unpack for us. One is Jesus was not attached to form, and also how to stand in the gap as a leader. So welcome to the show this evening, and I'm going to hand this off to someone to jumpstart our thought process and our questions around the table. Who would like to go first? Okay, Ms. Holston.
Thank you very much. I was particularly inspired this week by both chapters, but let's jump in maybe with the form. And you talked about how, you know, God isn't tied to form, but we as humans tend to be tied to form. And you talked a lot about that we need Jesus with skin on, and sometimes in that absence we create or we divert our attention to other things so that we can have a tangible form, and we kind of misproject our love, affection, and attention. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about what are some of those common pitfalls and forms that we're tempted to attach our value to, our attention to, our desires to.
Well, I just had to kind of chuckle when, at the chapter title, He Did Not Stand in the Gap, that made me think of the store, and I myself have stood in the gap many times looking for outfits, so that leads me to consumerism, and that can be a form that we get attached to. Certainly in this country and around the world, we've had lessons in systems changing form. The mortgage industry has changed form. The American dream has changed form. The people that were trusted institutions are now being subpoenaed and, you know, possibly being sent to jail, some of the leaders. So whenever we attach too much importance to the way things look, even if it's our own religion, our own denomination, our own relationships, our job, and in Jesus Career Council, I wrote about that extensively, that, you know, if you think your job is your mission, then when you lose your job, you're going to be sunk. But I really think it's important that we remember that God can create something from nothing, a mustard seed. Jesus talked about faith. Having the faith of a mustard seed grows into a great vine. So I think that God is constantly teaching us lessons not to get too attached to the way things look. So relationships, religion, money, success, getting your kid into a certain thing, we get really caught up in the way we think it needs to look, and we forget about the spirit of what we're trying to do.
Wow. Yeah, and I think there's a balance between having principles and live by principles and just being cut or being attached to a form. And so one thing is that you have principles, but life is a changing, evolving is full of surprises, and your principles guide you, but then how can you make sure that you're still following your principles, but you're not being contained by a form?
Well, I think by nature, principles don't have form. You know, principle isn't a thing, it's a way of being, no matter what the circumstances are. So I remember watching a television program, West Wing, and it was just amazing to me how these people who had gotten elected had to make decisions literally walking and running down the hall, these huge decisions, and they'd have 20 minutes to get into a group. And I know when you worked at the Mexican consulate, same thing. You have to be driven by principle because you cannot follow a handbook fast enough to help you decide what needs to happen in a leadership situation.
This principal has a form. But anyway, and speaking, getting back to my principles, I always have to ask a question about just the alignment of the topic of the day and the elements. And so looking at the idea of form, are there elements that are more tempted to attach value and worth or be distracted by a form as opposed to principle?
Yes. I think Earths particularly are vulnerable to being attached to form. They want things to look a certain way. Fires can also be vulnerable because they want to see something as a source of fuel for themselves. And I write in a number of my books that Jesus, you know, they missed Jesus because he didn't come in the form that they were counting on. God decided to play surprise, and I'm going to send you a little baby in a box. And he's going to come from the least likely city, and there's going to be scandal attached to his birth and all these things, which were totally not the form they were expecting. Someone like Elijah to come and, you know, heavenly hosts and chariots blazing. And so I just think it's a really good mindset to think about God loving to play surprise. And yesterday I was sitting out on, I've moved to a downtown high rise, and I was on the 12th floor of my terrace, and a hummingbird came up and was staring me right in the face. You know how they, I know that's one of your favorite things, Vicki. Just 12 stories up, a hummingbird in downtown San Diego, and it was like, hi, God. I see you. It was a little greeting from God saying, hello, I see you. Goodbye. So how fun it would be to really think of God as playing surprise all the time, and I think that would help. Children know the game, and they love it. But as adults, we don't like surprises. We want things to be a certain way all the time.
Yeah, one of the things that that I'm thinking about right now is a passage, and I was trying to search my my memory bank, and it's not coming up. But the context is that we have a form of godliness, but we deny the power of Christ because we take on a form. Whether, Lori, you had talked a little bit about this in this particular section of perspective of, you know, how religion becomes a form, how denominations become a form, and we begin to worship the form. But we really deny the power of Christ and the power of God in our lives. And that kind of just sat with me for a second as you all were sharing about form. But how do we, as leaders in organizations, profit or nonprofit organizations, how do we lead without attaching ourselves to the form?
Well, I think it goes back to leading by core values and principles. And you can expect a certain outcome, but if you do the process, then the outcome may be different. But as long as you're being true to the process and the principles, then you're going to get the results. And I talk a lot about this in The Path, that when you get your mission statement, you can't always know the form it's going to take. Like when I wrote my mission statement to recognize, promote, and inspire divine connection, I didn't know that I was going to write a book about Jesus. And I had no idea the path it was going to take me on, literally and figuratively. I could not have predicted that. But every day I would ask myself, am I living my mission today? And that's why knowing your mission is such a freeing force in your life because it can help you not get attached to the results, but stay engaged in the process.
And perhaps you just gave the answer to the question I'm about to ask.
Moving on.
But I'm going to ask it anyway. This weekend I went with a group of some teachers and some friends of theirs to see Waiting for Superman. And we were sitting discussing the movie afterwards and its implications for our school and what can we do to build and to grow and to move beyond. And we were talking about some of the pitfalls that we've experienced in our school. And one of the things that I was talking about that has been a big challenge for me as a leader is, and I think it has to do with form, there's a connection here, is that moving people from commitment to compliance, and I think I'm aligning the principle-driven leadership with commitment, and then I see people that follow because of compliance, and I see them being the most attached to the form. And for me as a leader, I struggle with how do I get them to back up from the form, to move beyond compliance to commitment. And I'm sure it does liken to their mission. But what would your advice be to an Omega leader to lead people past form to principles, from compliance to commitment?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what you mean by compliance. Give me the context of this.
Well, doing what they're asked, checking the things off of a list, doing what they've been asked to do, but still
the heart's
not in it. They're doing what they're compliant, but they don't necessarily haven't grasped yet the principle, bigger picture.
Back to the form of godliness, but denying the power.
Exactly. They're engaged in the form. Right? And they're following the form, and they're good with the form, but they can't let go of the form to step back and apply the principle, which I think is what ultimately impedes progress, achievement, or success.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So how do you get someone to do that? I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer. All you can do, I think elementally you're going to have some people that the waters might go along to get along, and the fires, and I think from a fire perspective, sometimes we, speaking as a fire, we underestimate the commitment of the earths and waters because it's more invisible. They move more slowly. They're doing their work underground. They don't have to have a lot of flash and splash to let you know that they're doing their job. So if I had a group that was committed, but I also had a group that was being compliant, I would actually be happy. Because at least the compliance, you know, somebody has to check off the boxes.
I have an idea for that, checking if it's a form or how do you move. And going back to asking why. So are you doing this? Why are you doing it? Well, because you asked me to do it. Okay, why? Do you think
we need to do it?
We need you to do it. And then why do you think it's important? And then why do you think? So I think that's the way, I don't know, that could be one of the ways to at least have them thinking about not the form, but a little bit beyond the form, going to the why is the root and the principle or what originated the project, the idea, whatever you're doing.
Yeah, like the rich young ruler, you know, was attached to the form.
Right.
Couldn't really get past the form to commit and surrender,
mm-hmm.
you know, which may have nothing to do with commitment.
Right.
But I think, you know, that's the big question in my mind right now is either moving them from commitment, from compliance to commitment, or moving them from, you know, as a leader from a place of, you know, let go of that. You know, maybe it did serve in 1820.
Right.
To do it that way. But we've hung on to the form of doing a task,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
a compliance,
whatever.
You know, checking off the list. But it's just not serving. It's not serving anymore. So then how do we do that?
Yeah, and I certainly wasn't anything against being compliant. That is necessary in organization. But I think the origin of the picture was we're trying to kind of analyze and discuss what are the stumbling blocks to moving forward. And that's kind of where that context came from. So there's been some great insight, the coaching and the questioning and stepping back to see the why, because it is like the rich young ruler. It's not that what they're doing is wrong. but it's not effective.
Mm-hmm.
It's not serving. It's not serving their ultimate purpose as
it was a
stumbling block as opposed to a benefit.
So if we look at the Omega Leader as the role model here, right, of this principle of perspective and how Jesus did not attach to forms, my gosh, how many examples can you think of? But then how did Jesus call the disciples out of those forms? What can you think of right off that comes to your mind? I'm busy, I'm fishing, I'm working. What do you want me to do?
Right.
You want me to leave my family?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, just name them all. Mm-hmm. You know, well, I need to see the wounds in your side. So they were attached to those things that were in the everyday space, and they lost sight.
Mm-hmm. Martha, Martha.
Yeah.
Powerful, powerful insight.
How about on the other one?
The gap.
Yes.
I love the chapter on the gap, and that was really inspiring as well. And the picture, the word pictures that you created of the paintings of the artist, Vicki, you had looked them up on the internet to kind of check them out. And I was so inspired by the one of the priest who is waist deep with the children's crutches left to one side, and the statement you made that he was teaching them how to be powerful instead of powerless. Talk to us a little about that.
Well, this whole idea of standing in the gap, and the Soroya painting that I talk about in the book we're working from is Jesus in Blue Jeans. It shows a priest, and he's standing. There's some lepers that are huddled against a wall, and these boys, maybe bullies, you know, 10 or 12 years old, are throwing rocks at these lepers, and the priest is standing, defending them and taking the blows, standing in the gap, saying, you can hit me, but don't hit them. And that's very much the way Jesus led. Don't, I'm the one you're looking for, rather than, and you know, I think, and just hearing that, those words, I'm the one you're looking for. In our earlier pre-show, we were having discussions about evangelicals and different approaches of bringing people to God. And I'm the one you're looking for. He's the only way, but I'm the one you're looking for. When he said that, he was defending, he was stepping into danger to defend the people he loved.
Right.
He wasn't out throwing people off a cliff because they didn't believe in him.
Right.
You know, so it's just a different spin on that. To stand in the gap is, I remember, and I talk about that in the book, about a woman who flew in from across the country to attend a young girl's graduation, and I was standing next to her, and I said, is your daughter out there? And she said, no, but I'm here because my best friend just died of breast cancer, and so I'm standing here for her mother, who cannot be here, so that the girl had someone standing in the gap. Big brothers, big sisters, family members, you know, standing in the gap. And I think as Christians, we're called to do that, to be the arms and heart of Christ in a painful and broken society.
I particularly, personally, really related to that. You talked about that sometimes it's non-family members that become one's family because they stand in the gap. And, you know, I think I'm here today because of a family that adopted me and stood in the gap and saw something in me and blessed me and believed in me and stood in that gap for me and spoke up for me and advocated for me. So it's really powerful. What are the dangers and pitfalls of standing in the gap? Can you stand in the gap too long? Can you be an enabler in standing in the gap? Can you?
Well,
yeah.
Standing in the gap is if the lepers were trying to get away and the priest was standing there saying, no, you cannot leave. You know? So it's one thing to stand in the gap. It's the other thing to stand in the way. Vicki, I think you have something you really want to say.
Well, I'm thinking in business how you stand in the gap when you, if somebody committed a mistake in your group, I think if you say we committed the mistake, mm-hmm. right? And if somebody has done something good, extraordinary, you say, this person did something extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
So, the, you know, taking ownership of the blame, because in a matter of as a matter of fact, it's a group that you're in charge of or whatever, and that I think goes way far away. You know, when you goes a long way, yes, and not far away, goes a long way. When when you stand for your people, I think the next time they're gonna try not to commit mistakes. You know, when they see that you're taking the hit, and it's not that you're gonna enable them, because I think that there's a balance. But hopefully the way you do it, instead of enable them to continue doing whatever the mistake or whatever, it triggers something in them to try better, to try.
I was just going to say there's a particular a gentleman named Rick DeFore that talks about that principle you're talking about. When you mess up, you look in the mirror as a leader. And when things go well, you look out the window. And you give the glory and the praise to your team. So speaking of teams and standing in the gap, let's kind of take it back to the elements. What elements are great gap standers, and what elements really need to be better about stepping up and standing in that gap?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that every element can do this. The waters can flow in and be loving. They can flow into the dry places. The wind can be the ruah, the breath of God, spreading the sweet fragrance around, literally helping people catch their breath. The fire, God led with a pillar of fire at night. It can be light up the darkness. And then the earth can stand in the gap by taking the blows and saying, you know, I can handle this, or following up with the details, making sure that the details get covered, that the box is taped properly, that the wind just, you know, shoved by the door to be mailed out probably late. So there's many ways to stand in the gap, and I think that it means becoming sensitive to the needs of the people around you. And, you know, Jesus noticed a baby bird that had fallen to the ground. He was concerned about the tweet that was not taking place.
Nice. Wow. So I'm sitting here, you know, kind of in awe of this topic, because it seems to me, whether it's in corporations, businesses, education, the church, healthcare, you know, whatever pillar we're talking about, it seems that, you know, we build this temple, this shrine within organizations where the doorkeepers and the gatekeepers are the ones who stand in the gap for the leader. And we were in a situation not too long ago where, you know, the inner court of this particular building was, you know, the access to this particular area. You had to have somebody with you at this church, or you needed the key card to get in. I mean, you just couldn't walk in to this particular area. And I'm like, why? You know, what is, this is a church. You know, this is a place that should be open to people. But we build this concept, I think, from this, the previous discussion of attaching ourselves to particular forms of how leadership looks, right? The form of how leadership looks. So then when it's time for us as leaders to step up and stand in the gap, we're not the ones standing in the gap. We've appointed somebody to do it for us. And so sometimes I wonder if that, you know, isn't keeping us from leading like we're supposed to lead, or, you know, does that interfere, Lori Beth, with how we lead? If Jesus stood in the gap and didn't throw people under the bus, how are we to lead?
Well, I'm thinking of a client I had years ago that, you know, the term scapegoat he actually kept someone on staff to be the scapegoat. And it took me a while to realize this, but it dawned on me that he needed that person to be the mess up, because then it took the heat off of him. And sometimes he assigned him tasks that were way beyond his capabilities, because this leader did not want to step into the gap because he was afraid he might fail. So he sent someone he knew would fail, so then he wouldn't have to take the heat if it went wrong. So he almost predicted that it would go wrong by assigning someone to do that. And certainly in society, we've had our scapegoats too, where we put all the sins of the people on them and then they get driven out into the desert. But I want to talk about an exercise that we do in the past seminar called the Cup of Sorrow. And I'll close with this exercise. And I'd like our listeners to do this with me. I'd like you to think about your parent, your dominant parent or parent figure in your life. And what cup of sorrow were they drinking? What were the ingredients in the cup of sorrow that they were drinking from? And, for example, in one seminar, a woman said, well, my little boy, I was swinging with my little brother. When he was 3, he fell off the swing, broke his neck, and died. And my mother never recovered. So you could say the death of the boy was the ingredient in the cup of sorrow. No, that was the triggering event. But what went into the cup of sorrow were regret, maybe bitterness, sense of loss, hopelessness, despair, depression. It's never the triggering event that goes into the cup. It's all the surrounding emotions. So take just a minute and think about what went into the cup of sorrow that your mother or your father were drinking from. In another seminar, we had a gentleman say, well, that was easy. My father was an alcoholic, so his cup was full of Jack Daniels. Well, what would Jack Daniels, an alcoholic's, what would be in an alcoholic's cup of sorrow? Low self-esteem, you know, lost opportunities, all those things. So you're, as a child, we want to be close to our parents. So you grew up sipping from this cup of sorrow, which is really almost a worldview. You know, one woman said, men are always going to leave you. You know, they're just no good. And so whatever was the dominant worldview, that goes into the cup of sorrow. So picture yourself, your mother, your father, just handing it to you over the years. And because you want to stay connected to them, you just take a sip and drink with them. Well, what's going to stop that? And it doesn't matter how old you are or even if they're dead, because you may still be drinking from that cup of sorrow. But I'd like you to visualize Jesus stepping between you and your parent. And just as your parent is about ready to hand you that cup, Jesus takes it and he drinks it all. And then he turns it upside down and you watch the last drop fall from that cup. And then he turns to you and he says, I was with your mother or your father when that happened, and I'm with them still. And I have drunk this cup of sorrow, so you are free to go. Mm. Jesus stands in the gap and drinks that cup of sorrow. And as you visualize the last drop hitting the ground, know that the cup is empty. He stood in the gap for you. And you are free to go. Now, if you come back and take that cup of sorrow and fill it up again, that's your choice. So Jesus stood in the gap for us. He wants to take the sorrows from us, generational sorrows, generational curses, if you will, and drink those and absorb those so that we indeed can be free to go. Do not get attached to the form of your sorrow. Jesus wipes all tears away. Good night.